found was the ring of keys with the lanyard of baby blocks. D-E-L-P-H-I-N-E. From school, the one I'd stolen and completely forgotten about. I darted toward him. In my side vision, horror on the faces of Spencer, the installers, and the hip older woman, their mouths trying to warn me off something. But I needed to get that awful name out of Timby's hand. I raised my chin just in time to see a flat piece of metal with layers of green enamel mottled like mold across my field of vision. Clunk! The last thing I heard before I sank to the floor was Timby's voice. What are you doing with Delphine's mom's keys? Troubled Troubadour. Long before Eleanor met Bucky, she'd heard the stories. Barnaby Fanning was the lone offspring of a marriage between two of New Orleans' finest families. Growing up in a Garden District mansion so iconic it was a stop on all the tours, the future heir to sugar and cotton fortunes both, his adolescence spent at debutante balls during the season and trips abroad during the summer. It was the stuff of true Southern gentlemen. But Bucky always refused the first table at a restaurant. He carried a pocket calculator so he could tip a strict 12%. When his father nudged him out of the nest after graduating Vanderbilt straight C's, Bucky fluttered only as far as the carriage house because no other address would suit. He sported head-to-toe Prada bought on quarterly pilgrimages to Neiman Marcus in Dallas, paid for by Granny Charbonneau. At the slightest perceived insult, Bucky would fly into rages, becoming so red-faced and spitty in the process that even those on the receiving end of his invective grew concerned for his health. During the holidays, Bucky would stand over the trash and drop in Christmas cards unopened while keeping mental score of who'd sent them. He never accepted a dinner invitation without first asking who else would be there. Bucky Fanning had never been known to write a thank you note. There was a girl once from an equally prominent family. A joining of the two of them would be the social equivalent of unifying the heavyweight title. Bucky would fritter away the hours on the veranda, dreaming of their wedding and life together. The girl was 5 years his junior. Bucky was at Tulane Law when she went away to Bard. The girl's first Thanksgiving back, Bucky arranged a party at Granny Charbonneau's, a proposal party. 100 local eminences were in attendance, a videographer on hand to capture the moment. But the girl, a bit fuzzy on her status with Bucky, entered on the arm of her boyfriend, a film major, last name Geisler, not German Catholic. It was widely appreciated that Bucky would never recover from the public humiliation. Indeed, he dropped out of Tulane. Bucky now spent his days at the Williams Research Center in the French Quarter, toiling away on a sprawling history of the Charbonneau family. He worked in the light-filled second-floor library in the mornings and walked to lunch at Arnaud's or Galatoire's, the only places that would allow him to dine with his beloved Pomeranian, Mary Marge, perched on his lap. In addition to his writing and seats on local charity boards, Bucky attended the Court of Kaus. Kaus was arguably New Orleans' most elite social club, or crew. Bucky's father had been king of Kaus, his mother queen. Bucky had been a page in every court. When he aged out, he was elected captain. King might appear to outrank captain, but Bucky was quick to point out that king was ceremonial, whereas captain wielded the real power over membership, court assignments, invitations, float design, charitable disbursements, etc. During the season, August through February, the court-related parties averaged 5 per week, climaxing in Mardi Gras, when the various crews rolled through the French Quarter on floats, tossing beads and doubloons to the public before disappearing behind closed doors, where that year's debutantes officially came out at lavish balls. Hierarchy, secrecy, exclusivity, pageantry, privilege, tradition, the Court of Kaus was Bucky's unified field theory. At times, Bucky's fervor for the debutante balls resembled that of a wedding planner character from an 80s romantic comedy, a fae-id gone wild. But New Orleans cosseted their eccentrics. The Scoogs had a grandfather who believed the Civil War was still being fought and indulged him with daily dispatches of Confederate successes. One of the Nisley girls spent second grade dressed as a little tramp. That the Fannings' eminently eligible son haunted the debutante scene but never seemed to risk romance, preferring instead to hover on the sidelines, sneering at certain maladroit dancers and settling scores through seating charts, that was no different. "I love this guy," Eleanor said to Lester, looking up from her light box at the Looper Wash offices. "He's really quite wonderful," Lester said. The stories came courtesy of Lester Lewis, who had roomed with Bucky at Vanderbilt. Eleanor had hired Lester as her number two. He was a meticulous draftsman who'd grown up on a thoroughbred farm in Kentucky, but was afraid of ponies. It was his idea to give the ponies of Looper Wash their ornery personalities. "Grr," Eleanor said, erasing the eyes on a laughing Millicent. "I'm terrible at eyes." It was 2003. Looper Wash was still a month away from airing, but the animators had been working for 2 years in a loft on the dodgy end of Broome Street. Eleanor had her own office, but she preferred the bullpen, working side by side with her New York team. Scores more artists hand-painted in Hungary. "Is there anything likable about your friend Bucky?" Eleanor asked. Lester had to think about it. "He's loyal." "But you can't genuinely like him," Eleanor said, raising Millicent's lower eyelids in an attempt to give her that smiling eye look. "We were devoted friends," Lester cried. "We speak every day." "Does he know you mock him behind his back?" "I mock him to his face," Lester said gleefully. Eleanor's team was color-correcting, making last-minute changes and throwing in topical jokes to Season 1, getting animatic notes on Season 2, and storyboarding Season 3. It was high-stress and sedentary work. 14-hour days hunched over drawing boards, vacations canceled, out-of-town parents stood up at fancy restaurants, weddings postponed, births of babies just missed. In the stranglehold of deadlines, a bunker mentality set in. The animators versus the idiot network executives versus the capricious and overpaid writers versus the incompetent and venal Hungarians. The one bright spot in the animators' day occurred after lunch when Lester would return from his daily phone call with Bucky and recount the highlights in delicious detail. For the next hour, a calm settled over the bullpen as the animators dissected Bucky across their lightboards. Did they love him, hate him? They took extravagant pleasure in the debate. If only there were some way to hear his voice. Eleanor suggested they get the phone guy to add Lester's line to the speakerphone in her office so the animators could pile in and listen in on him and Bucky. "Please," Eleanor asked Lester. "He's all we have." A rush order was submitted. Bucky didn't disappoint. "I'm every shade of aggravated," Bucky at home settling onto his daybed after an especially rich lunch. His voice was confident and strangely accent-free. Eleanor passed a note to Lester. "Why doesn't he have a southern accent?" Lester nodded and gave Eleanor a wink. "Bucky," Lester said, "the other night I started to explain to someone your philosophy on southern accents, but all I could remember was that it defied logic." "Southern accents are hillbilly," Bucky said with petulance. "Anyone with a proper education, I don't care if he's never set foot in the South, doesn't go around sounding like Jubilation Tea Corn Pone. If he does, it's a put-on. And please, I'm in no mood to rehash the obvious. I've just had a knockdown drag-out with the mail lady."
"No kidding," Lester said.
"As you know, I had a mailbox made for the carriage house. Last week, I left a note stating that from now on, all mail addressed to Barnaby Fanning was to be delivered there. Every day it's been empty.
Today, I confronted her, and she said that by law, anything addressed to 2658 Coliseum had to be put in Mummy and Daddy's box. If I wanted mail in a different box, I'd need a different address. She kindly suggested I traipse down to City Hall and have the carriage house designated 2658A. Can you imagine? Barnaby Fortune Charbonneau Fanning, 2658A? She obviously doesn't know. This Buckyism worked its way into Looper Wash. Season 2, Episode 20. Josh, the kindly and patient sheriff, refused to arrest a drifter for stealing the girl's rock tumbler. Vivian stormed off saying of Josh, "She obviously doesn't know." "Perhaps," Lister said, "the post lady would have been more accommodating if you'd given her actual money for Christmas instead of re-gifted potpourri." "I suppose next year I could throw in some car wash coupons," Bucky said dryly, playing along. "He's addictive, this guy," Eleanor said as they hung up. February drew near. The anticipation became palpable. Not for the premiere of Looper Wash, but for Mardi Gras and Bucky's account of riding on the cow's float. Could he possibly deliver after all the hype? "Standing there in my white tights and sparkling shoes, my gold lamé shorts, silk mask and hair wig." What's a hair wig? Somebody scribbled on the whiteboard. Nobody knew. "Tossing beads to the lowly throngs, 10 deep between me and the blue wall of porta-potties, entire families with their Deuce McAllister jerseys, acid-dyed shorts, and $18 haircuts springing up from their lawn chairs, knocking over their hibachis, heads back, mouths opened like baby sparrows, fingers grabbing at the air, hoping for a lucky throw." He paused to marinate in the memory. "I know how Lindbergh must have felt." Eleanor's boyfriend Joe had dropped by to take her to lunch. He entered during the tail end of Bucky's monologue and was violently shushed. When the call ended, the room exploded into victorious whoops. "Bucky!" Eleanor explained to Joe. You gotta love him."
"Do I?"
A week later, the animators were huddled in Eleanor's office.
"Your big 3-0 is coming up, Mr. Lewis," Bucky said from the speaker.
"What are our plans?"
"Eleanor's throwing me a party at her place."
"Your boss, Eleanor?"
A sniff could be heard from the speaker.
"Do you have a cold coming on?" Lester asked with a wink to the busting-a-gut animators.
"Remind me of her last name," Bucky said.
"Flood. She's related to President John Tyler."
"A direct descendant?"
"Her mother's name was Tess Tyler," Lester said, looking over at Eleanor to make sure that was correct. "Eleanor has a pair of John Tyler's derringers in her apartment to prove it."
"A direct descendant of a U.S. president in show business? I must be a witness to such a travesty first hand."
"Inform her I'll be attending her little fete."
It was Captain of Kaus himself riding his comet to New York City. Eleanor's team did what all feral and procrastinating animators did. They came up with a wager. Everyone put in a 20, and whoever came the closest to drawing an accurate Bucky would win the pot. The Internet has since fiercely debated why the Looper 4 were so sloppily rendered in the Guitar Zan episode. The answer? Bucky Fanning. Most of Bucky's submitted were stump size, some bow-tied gentleman of yore, one a drooly fly-swarmed hayseed. Eleanor settled on an average height, balding, driving moccasins, no socks, wool pants, floral button-down, and lavender cashmere sweater tied loosely around the shoulders. She threw in oversized Versace aviators with gradient lenses. The day arrived. Bucky strode into Eleanor's office. Bucky, in the flesh. He was indisputably handsome. tall, perfect skin, sensual lips, luxuriant, wavy hair. Lester had often insisted Bucky was attractive, so why can't he get a date? Eleanor had asked.
He doesn't want a date, Lester explained. He wants someone who won't leave him.
Bucky wore black, black bomber jacket, black cashmere crew neck with a black silk T-shirt peeking above, black leather ankle boots with the red Prada stripe up the heel. Slightly ridiculous, but only if you knew Bucky was a social cripple with no job. Otherwise, he looked like any other wealthy hipster on the streets of Soho. More than anything, Bucky had an imposing presence. He wasn't fat, exactly. He reminded Eleanor of how papayas swelled during the rainy season, or the way Greg Gumbel looked like someone had taken a bicycle pump to Bryant Gumbel. Bucky's eyes immediately landed on the 20s spilling out of a wire in-basket.
"What's the bet?" he asked.
Panicky eyes swung to Eleanor.
"There's no bet," she answered too quickly.
"There's a bet," Bucky said calmly. Beside Eleanor on the couch sat a coffee filter filled with honey mustard pretzel nuggets. Her hand reached for one. Bucky took in Eleanor for a beat and nodded, as if that told him all he needed to know. He turned to Lester.
"I made us a lunch reservation at Balthazar, Mr. Lewis. I presume that is up to your middling standards."
It should have come as no surprise to Eleanor that at Lester's party her baby sister Ivy, Ivy the Willowy, translucent one with a fluttery aura, she was the air and Eleanor was the earth, Ivy, 6'1" in 9th grade, who a month before graduation went to model in Paris and then Japan, but had no luck in New York, where it mattered, who followed an acting coach to the Berkshires, which ended up being a cult and had to be rescued by Eleanor and her then-boyfriend Joe, Ivy, who miraculously booked a Dior campaign so her face was all over the subways one summer, but lost all that money and her modeling connections in an ironically named Ponzi scheme, friends helping friends, Ivy, who hitchhiked to Telluride in an ayahuasca ceremony and stayed 3 years shacking up with the shaman, Maester Mike, next finding religion in fat is a feminist issue, toxic parents, and healing the shame that binds you, this Ivy, who became a certified masseuse but quit because the constant transfer of bad energy was making her weak. She was allergic to wheat and cut out sugar before anyone was allergic to wheat and cut out sugar. She also refused to eat meat because it was biting into animal screams, and she avoided nuts because viruses clung to nuts. The Ivy whose skin had become flaky and eye sockets saggy, who couldn't shake her angry dry cough, who Eleanor's by-then-husband Joe, a surgeon who knew a dying bulimic when he saw one, checked into an eating disorder unit on 2nd Avenue where Ivy was forced on arrival to eat sloppy Joe on a white bun, despite sobbing and gagging and collapsing on the linoleum floor, Ivy, who was now answering phones for David Perry, rock and roll manager and husband of Violet, the head writer of Looper Wash, as a personal favor to Eleanor, Ivy, who was now 33 and healthy, if getting a little old for her act, it was this Ivy who came to Lester's party, it was this Ivy who met Bucky, captivated Bucky, went back to the St. Regis with Bucky and to New Orleans the next day. A year later, they were married. The engagement party was held in New Orleans. One of Joe's rules, the first thing you do in a new city is take the public transportation. He and Eleanor chugged along St. Charles in the overstuffed streetcar. From afar, the live oaks seemed to drip with Spanish moss. But up close, they were just Mardi Gras beads, months old, stuck there. Eleanor and Joe hopped off at 3rd Street and crossed. The Fanning Estate was on the good side of the avenue, the riverside. 2658 Coliseum stretched the entire block, its iron fence skillfully wrought into stalks of sugarcane. A plaque told the history, but it was too dark out to read. The mansion glowed from within. Eleanor balked at the gate. The disbelief had been hitting her in waves since she'd gotten the news that Bucky had proposed to Ivy on the plane to New Orleans.
"All I require is that you love oysters," he told her. "But I don't love oysters. You will."
Eleanor had shown up at work that Monday, her in-basket still rich with 20s. Nobody had the heart to claim them. The joke wasn't funny anymore. Lester had marched manfully into Eleanor's office.
"There's a good chance it won't work out."
"I'm happy for them," Eleanor said, and returned to her work. "Could you close the door?" The mansion door swung open, courtesy of a courtly black man in tails with white hair and white gloves. He was Mr., the husband of Taffy. Both uniformed servants to two generations of Fannings, and hopefully a third, now that Bucky had returned from New York with, of all things, a bride. Eleanor and Joe entered. The living room was a swish with ball gowns and tails. Just as an "oh" was about to escape Eleanor's mouth, she'd worn flats and a knee-length dress she'd had no time to iron. A mint julep was thrust into her palm. The shock of the frosty silver tumbler slapped Eleanor's face into a smile.
"Eleanor! Joe!"
It was Ivy, wearing a pleated chiffon gown, lime with orange flowers and sleeves that hung like calla lilies. She gave it a twirl. 1972, Lily Pulitzer. It belonged to Bucky's mother. "Did you know that if you admire something, the person has to give it to you? That's the Southern way." Ivy took Eleanor's hand and introduced her around. Ivy's frailty was still there, but without the undercurrent of unpredictability. No, being adored by Bucky, and she was adored, no question, the way his soft gaze infused her with ease, the delight they took in each other's words, the way his forearm fit the curve of her waist, had softened Ivy's edges. One might say she'd grown into her frailty. The South was a good place for that. Politicians and oil barons, lawyers and historians, shipping titans and ne'er-do-wells, to a person, they loved Ivy, had fully embraced her and, by association, Eleanor and Joe. Eleanor had never before felt so fascinating. In turn, those she spoke with became fascinating, and so the bonhomie spiraled up, up, up. The air felt cozy with kindness and laughter, not like New York, where people you talk to perpetually scan the room for someone better. A week earlier, at a Fox Network party, a Simpsons writer had literally pushed Eleanor aside mid-sentence when James L. Brooks walked in behind her. Manners, Eleanor grasped through the haze of mint juleps, weren't a function of hollow snobbery and misguided airs. They were acts of profound generosity. Granny Charbonneau sat sternly in the corner, both hands firmly gripping the long handle of her cane. At one point, she flapped her hand at Eleanor.
"Are you the sister?" Granny Charbonneau barked. "Maybe you can convince Bucky to stop dressing like a hangman."
At the food table, Eleanor couldn't get enough of the hot spinach dip. Taffy leaned in and shared the secret ingredient, Campbell's cream of mushroom. Bucky's mother led Joe over.
"This one I just want to slip in my pocket."
Earlier in the day, she'd cut her forearm sharpening the blade of the push mower.
"Mister hurt his back, and that's the alternative, to hire a team of gardeners. I can cut my own lawn."
Later, Eleanor found herself alone. She dropped into a fussy love seat. The pillows hit her low back in just the right spot. Mary Marge leaped onto her lap and curled up.
"Hello, you,"
Eleanor said to the pooch, startled by how thick-tongued it came out. She was unaccustomed to the relentless salvos of alcohol. Chunky leather scrapbooks lined the coffee table. Their sumptuous padded covers begged to be open. Eleanor obliged. On the first page was a truly weird photo. The Royal Court of Kaus. Grown men and women in outlandish costumes, their faces morbidly serious, more waxen than human.
Bucky, in a beaded gold satin shirt, gold shorts, white tights, rouged cheeks, a platinum blonde Prince Valiant hair wig, and a fountain of ostrich feathers springing from his gold headpiece, stood among the similarly lurid king, queen, pages, and maidens. Those parties start in a month. It was Ivy with Bucky. I couldn't be more nervous. Bucky's making me take curtsying lessons so I don't embarrass him before the court.
Ivy, my love, Bucky said with mock exhaustion. They're not parties. They're balls.
Finally, someone to do all my thinking for me, Ivy mimed, plucking her head off her shoulders and handing it to Bucky.
Bucky, Eleanor said, straining to enunciate. I want to thank you for making my sister so happy.
My life would have been a failure if I spent making your sister happy, Bucky boomed. I won't rest until the sun and the moon redden with shame, knowing Ivy outshines them both.
We're flying to Italy to have me fitted for white gloves, Ivy said. If you're sitting in the front row, the gloves have to be over the elbow. Don't you love it?
It's on the front row, darling, Bucky said. One sits on the front row.
Joe had a nickname for Ivy, the Monstrance. On certain Catholic holy days, the Eucharist was displayed in a golden sunburst monstrance where worshipful eyes gazed at it around the clock. Joe, an altar boy, had often been tasked with the graveyard shift. In Bucky, this living monstrance, Ivy, had found her perpetual adoration. Eleanor's shoulders melted. Something deep in her jaw loosened. Ivy was going to be okay. Their mother had died at St. Vincent's. Those final visits, once so vivid in Eleanor's mind, had faded with time. The old woman in the next bed being wheeled out for hip surgery, then wheeled back in 30 minutes later when they didn't have the right instruments. The bag of dark urine hanging from the bed rail. Their mother, the Broadway star, dry-mouthed and distant. On one of her last visits, Eleanor had brought a picture she'd drawn. Tess, with a grown-up Ivy and Eleanor, all three improbably wearing wedding dresses. "This is lovely, Eleanor," her mother whispered. "But it won't work." Eleanor cherished the memories of her mother, being picked up at school by Tess in her dance clothes and blue fedora, fringe purse swinging at her hip, listening to Tess, Gigi, and Alan gossip outrageously about the other dancers in the company, Eleanor not quite following, but, oh, the thrill of joining in the laughter, the parties that ended with everyone standing around the piano singing show tunes, the Cornish game hens for dinner, the exotic scent of Erno Laszlo facial products, the dazzling contents of her jewelry drawer, the lazy afternoons at the Bowlmore. But these recollected moments also carried extreme guilt. Eleanor was old enough to remember how much Tess enjoyed her company, how unhurried their moments were together. Ivy remembered only the abandonment.
"Please don't hold it against me," Bucky told Eleanor, "but the future Mrs. Fanning and I must beg our exit. The Times Picayune has arrived."
With Bucky gone, ruddy-cheeked Joe joined Eleanor.
"Wow," he said, the pillow hitting his back in the sweet spot.
"I know."
"Make room, make room!"
Lorraine, Bucky's second cousin, nestled between them.
"Get that rat off you!"
She pushed a snoozing Mary Marge onto the floor and waved over some champagne.
"Can you believe how seriously everyone takes this?"
Lorraine said of the scrapbooks. She opened up to her year. There she was, the queen of cows.
"Look how thin I was. I know what y'all are thinking. It's money tomfoolery, and you're not wrong, but I'll tell you, it's a gas."
Across the room, Bucky arranged Ivy's train for a photographer. Behind them hung a portrait of Bucky's ancestor, P.G.T. Beauregard, the Confederate general who ordered the first shot fired in the war between the states.
"Oh, Barnaby," Lorraine said with a mixture of fondness and spite. "Anytime he vexes you, and he will vex you, just remember, he's a troubled troubadour. It's a nickname we gave him. We were in the car when Kurt Cobain shot himself. The announcer came on the radio and said, "Troubled Troubadour Kurt Cobain has been found dead." Name just stuck, Troubled Troubadour. He's not so bad once you realize it gives him great comfort to know where he stands.
It was Irish coffee now, and who wasn't comforted by knowing where they stood? The birds with the cascading tail feathers on the wallpaper, the buttered colored ceilings, the gold mirrors and jute rugs. The effect wasn't pretentious. It was comforting, just like the blue and white striped love seat. Who would have thought blue and white stripes went with butter and birds and gold and jute? But it worked. So did being looked in the eye when people spoke to you and teens in tuxes conversing with adults. Why not waiters in tails and white gloves? Why not Bucky's mother and her friends in decades-old dresses, sun-damaged skin, frosted pink lipstick, and low, chunky heels? Why not flowers with the garden and dinged-up julep tumblers and food that was good but not great? When Dixieland music started playing, the splash of the trumpet and belch of the tuba confused Eleanor at first because it was clearly live but not coming from inside. Then, faintly through the garden windows, Eleanor made them out. Joyous black kids in short sleeves and neckties playing for the party, outside so it wouldn't be too noisy. They could see in, but Eleanor couldn't see out. Why not that, too? The next morning, the jagged double ring of the hotel phone startled Eleanor awake. It was Ivy, tentative, asking how Eleanor had slept, but not wanting to know how Eleanor had slept. Bucky was upset about the cachet pot. "What's a cachet pot?" "You don't know what a cachet pot is," Ivy said. "It's a porcelain pot for hiding things. Last night the ice cream was meant to go in one. Instead, it got plucked down on the sideboard in its carton. In the Times-Picayune this morning, you can see it, bold as life, right there among the Charbonneau china, dryers." Eleanor vaguely recalled, when the Bananas Foster was served, someone had asked for ice cream. At the time, Taffy had been on hands and knees working on a wine spill, so Eleanor went into the kitchen and set the ice cream out herself. "I know," Ivy said. "We finally got to the bottom of it." Was this a joke? "You made Bucky look like a Philistine on a night that should have been a celebration of our engagement." "It was a celebration of your engagement," Eleanor sat up in bed. Nausea welled. There was an odd hesitation before Ivy spoke. Was it Bucky whispering? "It was an insult to Bucky," Ivy said. "It was an insult to his parents, and worse, it was an insult to Taffy." "Taffy," Eleanor said. "I was trying to help Taffy." "That's just it," Ivy said. "Taffy doesn't need your help." "I'm sure she didn't take it as an insult." "Bucky did, and I did." Joe was awake now and shaking his head. "Put Bucky on the phone," Eleanor said, tears coming down in sheets. "I'll apologize." "He doesn't want to get on the phone." "I'll apologize in person, at breakfast." Another weird pause. "It's been a long night around here, waiting for the Times-Picayune to be delivered. Anyway, it's the type of thing that should be done in writing. You can leave a letter with the concierge." Eleanor flew to the desk and clawed at the sliver of a drawer, wild for stationery. Joe had his running shoes on.
"It didn't work for Neville Chamberlain," he said.
And then he headed out. John Tyler, a Virginia legislator, was added to William Henry Harrison's Whig ticket solely to deliver the Southern vote. When Harrison was sworn in on a freezing 1841 day, Tyler attended the inauguration. That evening, he returned to his plantation in Virginia, expecting a few vice presidential duties. A month later, a hand-delivered letter informed him that Harrison had died of pneumonia, making John Tyler the 10th president of the United States. Tyler, nicknamed His Accidency, governed without distinction. He chose not to run for re-election and, when his term was over, returned to the family plantation, Sherwood Forest. Because he accomplished so little in office, John Tyler is known in history books mainly for being the president who fathered the most children, 15.
Because he was later elected to the Confederate Congress, Tyler is also known for being the only president upon whose death the nation's flag did not fly at half-mast. Sherwood Forest is open to the public, although few tourists find reason to take the trip down Route 5, the John Tyler Highway, to the tidewater of Charles City County, Virginia. Astonishingly, John Tyler's grandson is still alive and resides there with his wife. Sherwood Forest's house at 300 feet is the longest frame house in the country. It includes a 70-foot by 12-foot ballroom designed for the Virginia Reel, Tyler's favorite dance. Sherwood Forest's 1,600 acres are dotted with former smokehouses, stables, and slave quarters. The 25 acres of terraced gardens include 100-foot magnolias and maples, as well as the first ginkgo biloba tree planted in the United States, a gift to Tyler from Commodore Perry. Over the years, the Tyler family had received countless requests to rent Sherwood Forest for private parties. They'd always declined. Which was why, when Bucky Fanning phoned the Tylers with a personal request to get married at Sherwood Forest and was refused once, twice, and three times, after which he got on a plane to Atlanta and drove the 7 hours to Charles City County to make a personal appeal, and the Tylers said yes, every toast at the rehearsal dinner mentioned this as quintessential Bucky. "Either run with the big dogs or stay on the porch," someone said. Bucky, you really did have to love him. Kaus's party planner oversaw the June wedding. She spent the day itself welcoming a fleet of vans to Sherwood Forest carrying straight from New Orleans oysters, crawfish, milk rolls, and the full Jimmy Maxwell Orchestra. She was also tasked with navigating the delicate challenge of having 164 guests on the groom's side and two on the bride's. The afternoon of the nuptials, Ivy and Eleanor lolled in Richmond Inn robes, Joe having just returned from a day trip to Monticello. In 2 hours, the bridal shuttle would ferry them to Sherwood Forest. Ivy, always the chameleon, spoke with a southern lilt. "I was lying in bed one morning. You know, my favorite thing in creation is an after-breakfast nap." Ivy took center stage on the vast expanse of beige carpet. Her eyes danced with wicked amusement. Had she learned it from Eleanor, the ability to turn any event into a story? "I swear to you, the wallpaper started moving. I got out of bed and put my hand on the spot, and it was warm. I found a pucker in the seam and pulled. Underneath were mud tubes like veins crawling up the walls. I screamed like the star of a teen horror movie. Termites!" Ivy's endless leg peeked through the high slit in her bathrobe, an effect so sexy it might have been staged. For Ivy, these alluring moments happened of themselves. "Not a week later, I went to mail a letter, and the mailbox fell off its post, right into the street. A group of tourists were standing around reading that old plaque, and I just about died of embarrassment." Joe grabbed a video camera to capture this, Ivy at her best. There had been bad times, but there were good ones, too. "The next day, the termites swarmed the carriage house, thousands of them, in a cloud you couldn't see through. That's how they mate, in flight. Poor Taffy had to stand there with the vacuum sucking them out of the air. They got in their eyes, in their ears, in her nostrils. She was spitting them out of her mouth. You know what else? After termites mate, their wings drop off. So for the rest of the year, wings in my cereal, wings in my slippers. Once I squirted sunblock in my hand, and there were wings in it. The craziest part, you mention termites to anyone in New Orleans, and they're in utter denial. 'What termites?' We had to call the Terminix guy because they'd gotten into the 2x4 things that hold up the roof. Bucky made them park around the corner. But when the neighbor came home and saw the Terminix truck in front of his house, he marched over, and he and Bucky had it out on the front lawn. Even after that, you mentioned termites, and Bucky will say, 'What termites?'" Ivy sat on Joe's lap and threw her arms around his neck. Oh, Joe, they fell back on the bed. You've always been there for me. I've been such a disaster. The good news is, after tonight, I'll be Bucky's problem. Bucky had entered. It was unclear how much he'd heard. He stiffly addressed Eleanor.
As you know, in keeping with Tyler tradition, my first dance with your sister will be the Virginia Reel.
He set a piece of paper on a bureau near the door.
Here are your places for it.
The door clicked shut. A choking silence filled the suite. Eleanor spoke first.
Okay, Joe, your turn to bust out the hotel stationery.
That's not funny. Ivy sat up and swung her legs around the side of the bed, darkness rising. Joe pointed to the suitcase. Eleanor nodded, went to it, took out a present.
From me to you,
Eleanor said, and sat next to Ivy. She turned to Joe.
Honey, cover your ears.
She took Ivy's hand.
Men will come and go, but we'll always be sisters.
From the weight of the box, Ivy's face exploded into a smile.
I know what it is, Ivy sang. John Tyler's Derringers. Bucky bet me a nickel.
Actually, no, it's not the Derringers. Eleanor had thought it right for the new couple to have at least one scrapbook devoted to Ivy's family. As their father kept no photos from their childhood, Eleanor had hand-drawn some of her own, as well as a map of Aspen. It had taken all her spare time for months. Eleanor was still feeling the physical toll. The frozen right shoulder, the aching eyes, the stomach lining eaten by coffee and ibuprofen. As a final touch, Eleanor had ordered the leather scrapbook from a stationery shop in the French Quarter. For its spine, she had a small silver plaque engraved in Fanning family font. The Flood Girls.
This is good, too, Ivy said. I have just the person you should meet, said Quentin.
Eleanor was back in New Orleans, in Bucky and Ivy's carriage house. They'd been married a year. Quentin was a rumpled gentleman with a full-on southern drawl who took impish delight in every word Eleanor spoke. She just told him she was Ivy's sister, an animator from New York. Quentin scurried off to find a pen and paper, leaving Eleanor standing in the living room facing the window treatments. Valence, curtains, swag, Roman shade, and blackout roller. Five separate things, six if he counted the silk tassels. Bucky came by sipping a screwdriver and joined Eleanor at the window.
Maroon and ivory is my favorite color story, he explained.
Color story, Eleanor said, snapping out of her trance.
One is a color, Bucky said. Two or more is a color story. Surely you know that.
And he left. A dozen family and friends were gathered around the Derringers, newly mounted on the wall above a plaque boasting their provenance. After Bucky and Ivy had named their baby John Tyler, Eleanor felt she had no option but to give them the pair of guns. Joe, sitting in a low chair in the corner of the antique-choked living room, had a different opinion. Quentin returned with a cocktail napkin.
If you're in animation, there's a fellow you should meet, Quentin said. Bucky's dear friend from Vandy. He draws that show we all love with the girls on the ponies.
He handed Eleanor a cocktail napkin with a name in Sharpie. Lester Lewis.
Lester Lewis, Eleanor said. Lester works for me.
Hang on a second. Bucky told you his friend Lester works on Looper Wash, but failed to mention I'm his boss?
Ooh, it looks like I stepped in something,